Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Casey Sepp. Casey is brand new to us, but she's not new in the writing community. She's written for The New Yorker. She's also, I think, on the road to stardom, and I hope we'll remember this interview. She's grew up on the Eastern Shore of Maryland, went to Harvard, and then as a Rhodes Scholar to Oxford, where she got her MPhil.
It's their fancy name for a master's. And it's a master's of philosophy no matter what you study, which I just think makes it very confusing.
But you were interested in religion.
Yeah, so I did that degree in religion.
Is that what got you interested in this story, that you were interested in the reverend, not as a con man and as a murderer, but as a theologian and a preacher?
Yeah, I mean, the truth is, look, straightforwardly, I came to this story the way a lot of people will, which is Harper Lee, but the reason I wanted to stick with it, I wrote a short article about it and then turned it into this book. And I do find the Reverend to be a very interesting character. And I think that religious authority is such an important thing to reckon with in our communities, because it's not so much that I think it's an interesting question whether the Reverend was sincere in his beliefs and what sincerity can look like. But I just think in general it's important to think about how we relate to spiritual authority. And in the case of the Reverend, one of the reasons this went on for so long is a lot of people defer to the clergy. And, you know, a lot of people thought at first it couldn't possibly be true. And, of course, it took a second wife dying for them to really put it all together. And so that's interesting to me. And, you know, we haven't even talked about the kind of weird rumors that grew up around the Reverend Maxwell.
No,
right.
You know, if we're going to talk about religion, let's talk about voodoo.
I was about to say. So, you know, poor Harper Lee, the headlines around this case, and there's a photo in the book of just the kind of national headlines, and they're voodoo priest, voodoo cleric, you know, voodoo shaman. When the Reverend kept getting away with this, people decided he was not a Baptist minister, that he was a voodoo priest, and that he was using voodoo to hex the jury, and, you know, he was using spells and potions to kill these people, and that's why the coroners couldn't find, you know, an appropriate cause of death. And so, you know, I didn't know much about voodoo, but it was fun to research it. It's a legitimate system of belief. There's a long history of it in the South, and so that for me was a lot of fun because I'm interested in religion.
But there was really no real evidence that he...
So voodoo is real, but there's no evidence that the Reverend dabbled in voodoo. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of those tricky things. You know, we were talking before the break about why this book was hard for Harper Lee. And I think that's a really good example. You know, it's odd to write about something like voodoo, which, again, is real, but was not real in this case. And, you know, meaning you're obliged to sort of account for it because it's how people talk about this story. I mean, literally people said the Reverend could turn into a black cat. And I thought they were just pulling my leg when I was looking into it. But Harper Lee adopted a stray cat when she was living in this town, and she called it Reverend Maxwell because there were already these stories about black cats and about his spiritual powers. And so I think for Harper Lee, who wanted just the facts and was planning to write, you know, a narrative nonfiction book, it was hard for her to figure out what to do with something like voodoo because, right, straightforwardly, the Reverend was not a voodoo. There's no evidence he dabbled in voodoo, he ever studied it, he ever practiced it. But that doesn't mean you can get rid of that from your book. You have to talk about it because it's how people talk about it.
So they did talk about it. One of the things that you mentioned that Harper Lee may have been an obstacle for her in completing this work was that while she had a tremendous talent for making people feel comfortable and talking, and she was warm and just amazingly drew conversation from them. Well, that worked, as you point out, with white people, but it was more difficult in dealing with a large number of black people. She was fine dealing with the people who worked for her family at home and black servants, but when she got out there in the real black community.
Yeah, I should say, first of all, you're talking about her being a great conversationalist. You know, as I gather, it was like talking to you, DJ, that people really felt comfortable and she was good at asking questions and she made time to talk to them. And so, right, you know, on the one hand, the reason she was so helpful to Capote and the reason her work started to go well with the Maxwell case is she was good at it and authentic and sincere and made people comfortable sharing even these dark stories of their lives. But, right, there are, you know, there are differences in different communities and different people and differences of gender and class and race in particular. And so, right, you know, this was black-on-black crime. These were marginal black communities in some of the poorest regions of Alabama. And, you know, Harper Lee at that point was a rich and famous novelist. And she had to figure out how to engage. Right.
Will you deal with this challenge in such a wonderful way, telling the three stories, one of Harper Lee, one of Radley, and then of the preacher himself,
right,
the reverend himself. Now, I really do want you to talk about your experience writing. How did you get – you came back home after your experience in Oxford. Had you already been writing and getting paid for writing, or how did that start?
Boy, so I had, you know, I was just a little like Harper Lee. So when she was in college, she had done some newspaper writing and wrote
Crimson, for the Crimson.
Yeah, so she wrote for the Crimson White, and I wrote for the Crimson. And I had written for my, you know, college literary magazine, and I loved writing, and
so
I loved reading.
So you're writing fiction, or are you writing?
Embarrassingly, I was writing very bad fiction for the literary magazine. But, you know, I was writing newspaper articles and columns and things like that. And so when I came back, I had studied religion, and I did more theological studies because I'm interested in religion, and you know, I just think it's such an important cultural force in America.
And so are you writing about religion?
Yeah. So a lot of what I ended up doing was covering, you know, I wrote some about the schism in the Methodist Church over LGBT.
Oh, wow. And who are you writing for?
For the New Yorkers. So I did a piece for them about one of those
about
early—
About the Methodist challenge.
About the split, yeah.
And basically on the ordination issue of—
it was sort of built around— It was mostly looking at one Methodist minister who had been defrocked for performing his daughter's—he officiated his daughter's wedding. And, you know, the Methodists have this curious polity where, even though his church had been very comfortable and happy to celebrate that, you know, another parish in Texas had not been, and so he was— You know, ecclesiastical court was convened, and he was defrocked. And so I wrote about that, and, you know, I wrote about a lot of things. I wrote about Flannery O'Connor's prayer journal, and I wrote about, just some books about religion I was reviewing.
Were these assignments, or were these things that you brought to the magazines you speculatively or got a—
It's a great question, and there's a little bit of it's kind of like speed dating. You know, sometimes an editor brings you an idea, and sometimes you bring them an idea, and you kind of hope to meet somewhere
but
in the middle.
You develop relationships with the editors when they trust you. They may not go for every idea that you've got, but they would like to find something that they needed that you could write.
Right, and I was lucky to have people who kind of knew what I was interested in books and religion. And
it was mainly for the New Yorker.
I actually have a piece in this weekend's New York Times Book Review, so some other places too. And, you know, the nice thing, I came of age as a writer when the internet was coming of age. And so even a place like the New Yorker, where they can only run a certain number of articles in the magazine, you know, you could write more for the web and get experience there and do different kinds of writing too.
Tell me about that. Did you get paid for the web?
Yeah.
Same rate?
Yes. Thankfully they pay for everything. And the truth is everybody has kind of moved to the web model where, you know, there's money for writers. And I think it's a good experience for people who are interested in writing. And one of the nice things about the book tour has just been the chance to talk to people about how you write a book and how you take an idea and shape it and find a structure. And I feel really lucky I had the kind of training wheels of magazine journalism, because you can sort of think of a book like this as a series of magazine articles that you have to kind of draw the shoestrings together so the shoe fits. And so I felt really lucky. I had actually, you know, probably about 10 years when I was doing freelance work, and not always full time. Sometimes
years after you got back from—
No, I started when I was in grad school, and so, you know, just time on the side of even when I was in grad school doing book reviews and cultural criticism and that kind of thing.
So when you're in England, you're doing this? Are you in
grad
school?
Yeah, did a few book reviews and things like that when I was at Oxford.
This is interesting. So just in a 30 seconds, what's next? Or can we look for another book, or are we just—
Yeah, I mean, look, unless you have 39 million listeners who are all going to buy a copy of the book, I can't live off the royalties like Harper Lee did. So I'm hoping to write another book and have a couple of things cooking for The New Yorker right now. So, yeah, I'll keep busy writing.
I think the best way, since you won't tell us what your next book is the way to keep up with you is keep an eye on The New Yorker might be the best way.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Once every couple of months we'll see something?
Yeah, exactly. It's pretty hard to be more prolific than that. But I think book two hopefully will be in the next few years. And hopefully, I'm looking into a shipwreck story. So it'll be pretty different from this, but it'll be another kind of mystery, if that makes sense.
I can't wait. Casey Sepp is the author of Furious Hours, Murder, Fraud, and the Last Trial of Harper Lee. She's also a wonderful guest. Thanks to her, and thanks to you for listening. This is D.G. Martin, and I'll be back here before you know it.